Welcome back to another edition of the D'Antonio Wiencast. My name is Ben Golliver. I'm with BlazersEdge.com. With me, as always, Kevin Pelton, cat lover, basketball stat guru, basketball prospectus, ESPN.com contributor. Any other sites that you're writing for now, KP?
I'm working on something for the Classic also. We'll add that to the list.
By the book, right? We got to say that first. We haven't done a podcast in, what, 18 months, so we got to pick up right where we left off. Buy KP's book. If you haven't bought it already, just buy it on principle. This guy gives you so much knowledge, it's ridiculous. The book is what, like $50?
It's five easy installments of, no, it's $19.95 for the printed edition or $10 for the downloadable PDF.
So something that I thought was going to cost $50 or be worth $50 is really only $19.95. Man, that's a real steal. Okay, so this is why we have you. It's these situations right here where everything is leaning emotionally one direction, and everybody knows what I'm talking about. It's Blazers coach Nate McMillan, another demoralizing loss on Tuesday night against the Washington Wizards. Really pathetic from start to finish, and obviously some tough circumstances with forward LaMarcus Aldridge going down with an ankle injury early. But, you know, it's out in full force. Let me read you some of today's headlines in order. Did the Blazers lineup changes come from above McMillan? With the question, is someone pulling McMillan's strings for him? After that, we have, after watching Tuesday's debacle, I wonder if McMillan's demise could happen sooner than the end of the season. With the headline, is the end near for Blazers coach Nate McMillan? We have another headline, no mistaking Blazers desperation. This kind of stuff could spell doom. And on and on. Then Dave chimes in with a very well thought out extensive piece entitled, is Nate McMillan in trouble? And he asks the question, when you deal with that kind of a loss and that kind of circumstances to that poor of a team, you play that poorly, all these indicators make people think, hey, you know, this could be bad for Nate McMillan. And not only just the past indicators, but the next five games prior to the All-Star break, it's going to be a tough, you know, a tough schedule, obviously. Just to recap, at Golden State on Wednesday, Thursday, Los Angeles Clippers at home, Saturday, Atlanta Hawks, Monday and Tuesday, a back-to-back road home with the Lakers and the San Antonio Spurs prior to the All-Star break. So you're talking about five easily losable games. If they did go 0-5 in that stretch, it would mark seven straight losses. It would also be 1-9 for their last 10 heading into the All-Star break. It's really difficult to imagine any coach with Paul Allen and his owner would be able to survive that stretch. So these are all the negative things that are around. But, KP, I know that you are Nate McMillan's biggest defender, his biggest fan. You're probably wearing a Sonics tie right now, so this is why we have you. You're going to explain why it's not Nate McMillan's fault, why he doesn't need to go. Lay it on me. What's your number one reason why Nate McMillan needs to stay here in Portland?
Well, you know, I speak from a unique position of experience here in that I've seen my team that I worked for and cheered for, supported, let go of Nate McMillan, and while, you know, the Sonics didn't fire him, certainly, and wanted to bring him back when he left for Portland, ultimately the result was trying to replace Nate McMillan as a head coach, and there was not one point from the day he left to the day the Sonics moved, which was about 3 years later, that we felt like that made sense or was a good decision or that he was in any sense adequately replaced in the three coaches that the Sonics went through. You know, the fact is I've not always been the world's biggest Nate McMillan believer. You know, I think towards the entry in his last season in Seattle, that 2004-05 season, the unexpected run to the Northwest Division Championship, I was a little skeptical whether Nate had really developed a winning philosophy and could implement that on the court. But, you know, at some point, both that season and watching the guys who followed him in terms of Bob Weiss and Bob Hill and P.J. Carlesimo, you know, I effectively came to the conclusion that, well, Nate and I may not believe in the same things necessarily on the court. The strength of his personality and, you know, his ability to get that across to his players makes him an above-average NBA coach. Not the best in the league, but someone who has done better than expected given the circumstances time and time again. And I think that there's enough credibility there that, you know, I don't think you want to risk going through what we went through in Seattle.
Great points all around. Okay, so we got a lot to unpack there. First of all, so it's fair to characterize this was, you know, a breakup that maybe wasn't on Seattle's terms, and it kind of left Seattle longing for the previous situation, given the immediate people who followed.
Yeah, definitely. The Sonics, I think, expected Nate McMillan to come back and were a bit surprised. And when he ultimately accepted Portland's offer and got so much money from Paul Allen to sort of be the face of rebuilding the franchise. So, they were forced to regroup a little bit. I mean, it did seem like potentially you could get someone in as coach who would, try to upgrade the defensive end of the floor, which was not a strength of those Sonics teams, and maintain a similar level offensively. But Bob Weiss was just a disaster. Bob Hill was somewhat more effective during his time at the helm. He was really kind of done in his second year by injuries to key players that left the Sonics out of the playoff race. And then we saw P.J. Carlesimo, have basically, he improved the defense a little bit, but the offense was horrible, and the veterans on that team, including Kurt Thomas, just really had, very little respect for the kind of sets the Sonics were running at that point and the way they were using Kevin Durant. And, ultimately that played itself out in how much the team improved after they replaced him with Scott Brooks down in Oklahoma City.
Very good. So you're talking about the power of his personality to connect to people, and that's what sets him apart from your average NBA coach. That's what is sort of his calling card. I think most people would agree that it's his motivation abilities or his abilities to put his, say, top two or three players in the right situations to succeed are his biggest strengths, right? So here's my question. I look around this Blazers locker room individually. I see Gerald Wallace as a very prideful person. I see Wesley Matthews as a very prideful person. I see Nicholas Batum as a very prideful person. I see, for stretches, maybe a little bit inconsistently, but I do see Marcus Camby as a very prideful person. He certainly, during his time in Portland, has shown a lot of pride, especially when he first got here, in terms of trying to, turn the corner and make this a team that could succeed in the playoffs. So I see all these guys, and Jamal Crawford, I think, has some pride to, his craft and knowing who he is and what he can do. So when I look at all those individual pieces, I say these are all prideful guys who take basketball seriously, who don't have a lot of distractions in their lives. And then I listen to Nate McMillan after the game on Tuesday night, and what does he attack? He attacks his team's collective pride. And I mean, how do you square that? What's up with the motivation? I mean, this is an above average motivator. This is a guy who's good at getting through to people, pushing the right buttons, getting them to play on the, the same page and put forth maximum effort. How is it that he's in a situation where they're giving up 124 points to the league's second worst offense from an efficiency standpoint? They're not playing any D. They're not rotating. They're giving up dunk after dunk after dunk. He's having to get a technical foul late in the game, and then he's blasting off about pride afterwards. I mean, how do you square that?
I mean, to me, that game last night was an outlier. The Blazers' problems this season, such as they are, and I think we can have a debate about how much they're real and how much they're kind of factors outside their control, but they have not been getting up for bad teams. That's the opposite. They've been just crushing these teams and making you wonder why they can't maintain that level of play against a better quality of opposition. So, I think that it was a horrible night, no question about it. There's no excuses, there's no defense for the way the Blazers play, but to read too much into one game in a 66-game season, is just a mistake to me.
I understand that outlook. So let's look at, let's, in context, last Saturday, Houston, their identity prior to that Houston game had been, hey, we understand we have problems on the road. We get that. We understand we have problems in late in games. We get that. But when we're here in the Rose Garden, when we're focused, when we're playing our best basketball, nobody can beat us. That was their mentality. I mean, that's sort of what the, how they identified, and that was sort of the crutch that they were falling back on in terms of some of these games that they had given away. You drop that game to Houston, and you get beat pretty thoroughly. All of a sudden, I think everybody wonders, hey, who are we? You follow that up with, a tough stretch. You get beat in double overtime. Felton looks awful. You barely escape with a win against the New Orleans Hornets. You come back home, and it's another, identity game. Okay, can you slam the door on a really bad team on the, start off a back to back to back, and get back to a sense of, really who you are and what direction you're going as a club, because these guys consider themselves an above average team. They go out there and lay, that one game egg, and now they're faced with losing Aldridge in a tough stretch of five games, like I mentioned. I mean, you can see how this is sort of, spiraling or accumulating. I mean, maybe it's not just one game here. Maybe this is going to be a 2 or 3 week stretch where, the momentum kind of slowly built after that Scott Foster call against Oklahoma City, and it's getting out of control pretty quick. So, I mean, wouldn't you agree?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that certainly over the last couple of weeks, we haven't seen, since that Oklahoma City team game, we haven't seen the same Blazers team that we saw before that. You know, that Houston loss was disappointing. But at the same time, you change the outcome of one of those games. If Jamal Crawford hits a three at the buzzer of the first overtime, I think it was in Dallas, and they win that game, all of a sudden that's a huge emotional lift. Finally, the close game, the road, it's all off our backs. You know, they come home in a joyous mood instead of a confrontational, practice Monday, which, Nate was obviously a part of making that happen. But then, he's constantly hearing from the media there, what kind of changes are you going to make? It's just, I mean, I think to me part of it is a reflection of the fact that basketball isn't played by robots. It's played by humans and coached by humans. And, when all of these close games go against you, frustration builds and things like that happen. And I think that's where, maybe the thing that's needed most of all is for everybody to just step back, calm down, and get back to playing basketball.
Okay, fair enough. So let me clarify one point you made there. So you're seeing this as sort of a media-fueled and maybe a fan-fueled phenomenon. I mean, you think that the media and the fans here in Portland, because of the intense scrutiny they put on players, because of, the negativity towards guys who are struggling, I mean, you really think that that's having an impact on what they're doing game to game here? I mean, you don't think that there's internal problems? You think it could be external distractions?
Well, I think it runs both directions because of the fact that the players are subject to the same, they're seeing the same things that the fans and the media are, certainly. But, I just get this real sense of negativity right now about anything that goes on with the Blazers. When I wrote earlier this week about the difference between their record and the point differential, my fundamental position in writing that is this is a good thing for the Blazers because you can't possibly keep losing 9 out of 10 close games. It's never happened before in NBA history, at least not to anyone remotely with the talent that the Blazers have. So your record is bound to get better, but everyone else, in the Portland fan sphere took it as, oh, look at this, we're the worst in NBA history. So, I mean, I think it's the two different perspectives on the same thing.
Well, I think we can all agree that there's one person who's in the middle of creating this constant negativity. And I think you can agree with me who that person is. And that would be Raymond Felton, right? I mean, we can agree that he is the lightning rod. He's the guy who is setting people off. He's the one who's performing so far below expectations when they made that trade, and really not just expectations for what he could provide, but expectations for what you needed given what you had given up on the terms of that trade. I mean, he's falling so far short. He's turning the ball over ridiculous ways, manners, quantity. He's shooting, basically lights on. I think that's the opposite of lights off. I mean, he's constantly in a well-lit room when he's shooting because he can't hit anything. He's the problem, right? I mean, he's the guy that you got to point to and say, this relationship between Nate and Felton is very important for determining whether Nate stays. Wouldn't you agree?
I would say Raymond Felton's performance is very important to determine that. I mean, I don't think that they have to be best friends. I don't think that Nate and Andre Miller ever were sort of in that position during Andre's time in Portland. But, if you look at Andre Miller's shooting numbers, and I've looked at this, I mean, his turnovers are up. That's definitely been an issue. I don't think his defense is where it was the last couple of years, probably because of the issue that we talked to death during the offseason about him, not being in peak basketball shape. that may be my understatement of the year.
Polite way of putting it, Gary.
That's a polite way of putting it. But if you look at his shooting numbers, he's still getting to the rim. He's still shooting a decent percentage there. He's hitting his long twos. It's just threes. And, if you're giving me the choice between looking at the sample size of, 63-pointers or whatever it is he's actually shot this year and the 500 he shot over the last two or three seasons, I think I know where I'm going to cast my lot.
No, I hear you, but I think it we come back to the same thing we're talking about earlier, which is this momentum that seems to be growing. And is there enough sample size left for him to get it back on track before frustration starts to boil over for a guy like Paul Allen? You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, sure. I mean, he's probably gonna come back and not be the 53rd or whatever best point guard in the NBA that he's rated right now, right? Like, he's probably gonna finish the season around 40 or in the 30s to 40s, or low 40s, my guess. So he's going to get better. I mean, just because he's been that pathetic and that terrible. But is that going to happen with enough time to save McMillan?
I don't know. I mean, I think that's where, this last loss and then LaMarcus Aldridge's injury is what throws things into confusion. I mean, ultimately, like Dave elucidated well in his piece today, we're talking about two very different questions. One question is, will the Blazers fire Nate McMillan? And the other question is, should the Blazers fire Nate McMillan? And, I don't know that anyone can predict what the Portland management is going to do, but, to me, it's more about discussing should they. And, my opinion on that is pretty clear.
Okay, so let me read this quote to you from Felton. I mean, this is priceless. Look at Jeremy Lin, Felton said. This is from Kerry Eggers of the Portland Tribune. Some people's systems are for players. D'Antoni is one of those coaches where people excel in his offense. He's a great offensive coach. And this is Felton talking about his former coach, D'Antoni, where he had probably some of the most success of his career. But I'm not going to sit here and knock anything Coach Nate has done. We're all fighting together, trying to figure this thing out. Being his point guard, I'm with him. I mean, isn't that sort of a player-to-coach kiss of death, even though he kind of tried to couch it and walk it back a little bit at the end? Once you start comparing Nate McMillan to Mike D'Antoni, clearly one of the NBA's best offensive guys, and you start to imply, like, hey, look at the player I was under D'Antoni. Look at the player that Lin's under D'Antoni. Now look at me under McMillan. I'm not the problem. I'm still the same guy I was in D'Antoni. McMillan's the problem. I mean, isn't that essentially what he's saying?
Ray has definitely been his own worst enemy at times this season with some of his comments. I think also his quote after last night's game about the Wizards just hitting shots. There's an element of truth there, but still, that's nothing that you need to necessarily say publicly. I think you just, at some point, either don't say anything or step up and, take the criticism and own it. And, I think that certainly is not endearing him to the fans at all. The interesting thing about Felton talking about his experience in New York, though, is that he actually got off to a really slow shooting start last year, too. And then I think it was about the second month of the season he was able to get going. And just, weren't the same expectations, A, in New York, and B, with an 82-game schedule and more space in between games, I think it was a little easier to come back from that kind of start than it is this season.
All right, so fair enough. I think you're saying that he can be his own worst enemy, and I hear that. I mean, I think some of the times he doesn't even know what he's saying, and I definitely think he's tone deaf to the fan base in terms of what they've come to expect from guys like Brandon Roy, Andre Miller, Steve Blake. The kind of competitor, guys who know exactly what to say after a tough loss to make sure the fans feel a little bit better. I don't think he has that in him at all. And frankly, I think that's one of the reasons why this team's sort of adrift. I don't think they have that leadership position in the backcourt right now. From anyone who's handling the ball. I mean, I think most of these guys, and Crawford's probably been the best guard in terms of performance this season, but he's mostly out for self. I mean, in terms of his game, he can run some pick and roll and get Aldridge the ball, but mostly he's looking to create his own shot. If you don't have that distributor who also has that, sort of forceful personality, you wind up, relying on your big men who don't necessarily have as much direct influence on the course and pace of a game because, they're kind of relying on other people to get the ball. So I think that's kind of been one issue that, he's fallen short, not only in his commentary, I think, publicly, but I mean, he definitely does not seem like a leader in this locker room whatsoever. I mean, guys are not rallying around him. People are sort of, having his back when there's criticism. If you go up to one of his teammates and say, "Hey, Raymond's really playing crappy," they're not going to throw him completely under the bus. They're going to say the right thing, but it's not like everyone's expecting Raymond to kind of carry the water like they expected with Andre. And I think that's a big problem because they need somebody like that right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it could have been either Ray or Jamal Crawford, who stepped into that role with Brandon Roy's departure and with losing Andre Miller. And, no question about it, both those guys have been disappointing. I think that The only question I would say is, the only way I would say it is that there's a slight difference between saying the Blazers need better production from their point guards and better leadership, and the Blazers need better point guards. Those are two slightly different questions. I mean, certainly if you have the opportunity to go out and get a Steve Nash without giving up Batum, I think you have to do that.
But
And
see, that's a pipe dream, though, KP. Come on. Can we agree to that? That's a pipe dream. I mean, the only person who wants that trade to happen is every Blazers fan. Why would anyone in the Suns, or why would anyone, Steve Nash, why would any of those guys want to come here right now? What is appetizing or appealing about the situation? I mean, Steve Nash has made it clear he doesn't want to go anywhere. Now he's going to just reverse course after years of that and say, hey, throw me into that giant mess. I would love to go play in that mud pile. I mean, come on, man. I don't see that happening.
Well, if there's anybody who would love the Pacific Northwest, it's Nash. But I'm just saying, if you have that opportunity, then totally,
I'm just trying to set the record straight because people ask me about Nash every single day. That's a pipe dream. I mean, we can pretty much agree, unless they go on some like 10-game winning streak before the deadline. That's a pipe dream.
That's fair. But what I'm talking about is, I hear a lot of people saying, well, the Blazers should go after Aaron Brooks when he comes back from China. Aaron Brooks, a shoot-first point guard who couldn't back up Steve Nash successfully last year, that's the answer to your problems. At this point,
That's just the desperation talking. That's just anyone but Felton. That's the ABF formula, anybody but Felton. I mean, he's the one name out there. If there's anybody else coming over from China, they'd want him too. People want Jeremy Lin like crazy. They'll take any. They want Nolan Smith, Elliot Williams. They want Patty Mills back. I mean, it's desperate, KP. That's what we're talking about. People here in Portland, they do think that there needs to be better point guard. They don't think that these guys, even if Felton turns it around and gets back to his normal, production, he's still not going to be good enough.
I just think that's a tough position to succeed in. If your belief as a fan is that you're trying to help your team win, then I don't know that that's doing it.
Fair enough. Let's read some more quotes here. We are frustrated and angry, but all that rah-rah talk and frustration and throwing chairs and all that, it's not equating out there on the basketball court, Marcus Camby said. I think it's pretty much wasted energy. Ooh. What do you take from that one?
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. There's been a lot of interesting quotes this year. Go back to, a few weeks ago. I forget which game it was after, but to talk about, we've got two nice guys and we're not holding each other accountable, which, I'm not sure is a very valid position. I think part of this is kind of like we talked about earlier. It's the guys on the team struggling to understand the disconnect from what they think they should be doing and the results they've seen thus far. And, I mean, I think that they're, in some ways, is befuddled and trying things as fans are.
I mean, I think, reality is kind of hitting a little bit. And I think that some of that frustration or some of that attitude from Camby was coming from the loss of Aldridge. So I do think these guys realize Aldridge is the one consistent guy on this team. This team's going only as far as he can carry them. They didn't know last night when those quotes were given when he was going to be back. They were starting to find out that he wasn't going to travel to Oakland, which is, generally not a good sign considering who's coming up. And I think these guys realize, hey, we can all play above our heads, but this group is not talented enough without Aldridge to do anything. I think that's sort of the mentality. And I think that's a fair mentality. I don't hold that against them. I mean, if I look at that locker room, and it's just like, honestly, it's just like Black Friday when Aldridge was getting his heart procedure and Roy and Oden had been announced as, they weren't going to be around. Crawford hadn't been signed yet. You go out there on the first day of training camp this year after the lockout, you look at that gym, who's in that gym, and you say, that's not a talented group of basketball players. I mean, there's some guys who can play, but there's not enough top-end talent to get it done. And I think those guys are sort of feeling that same thing, and they know it better than anybody. I mean, they know where they're at compared to the league by this point. And I think they realize without Aldridge, I mean, what's the point?
Well, hopefully there's still enough talent to beat the Washington Wizards at that point.
Well, I mean, I think that they could have certainly given the Wizards a better game, and they should be able to beat the Washington Wizards without Aldridge. But still, I mean, I don't think that the disparity between the Blazers as an average team or a slightly above average team with Aldridge, it's a below average team in terms of overall talent without him. I mean, there's just nobody consistent. There's nobody stepping up. I mean, your next best player is probably Batum or Wallace if he's playing well. I mean, the drop from Aldridge to everybody else is so steep.
Yeah, I mean, I think that reflects one of the difficult aspects of this year's team is that you've got basically after Aldridge and maybe Gerald Wallace, who hasn't played as well since he hurt his finger, or so, you know, he's maybe slipped back into this group. You've got like six guys who are all credible NBA rotation players and possibly starters. You know, Jamal Crawford's been in that six-man role most of his career, but you know, all of them think that they should be playing 30 minutes a game for understandable reasons. And then you've got to figure out a way to kind of manage all of those. And I think that's been one of the great difficulties of this season, where, you know, and I don't think that this is can be blamed too much on the Portland front office because of the fact that they were scrambling to put together a roster after, you know, the loss of Brandon Roy. But, you know, they put Nate in a position where someone's always going to be unhappy with their minutes, and there's going to be a little confusion about pecking order.
Yeah, we can get back to who we blame for this mess in a second, but let's finish up with the quotes here. So Wallace and Batum last night both backed McMillan. Wallace says, "I don't think it has anything to do with the coach. This is all on the players. The coaches, they can't get rebounds for us. They can't pinpoint passes. Turnovers in bad situations are killing us. Second chance points." Batum says, "Of course, that McMillan still is getting through to the group. It's on the players. We're the ones on the court. We have to bring some game. That was us, not the coach." I would assume that you're agreeing with that assessment. I mean, is this an effort thing, or is it an execution thing, or what would you pinpoint? Or would you say, okay, maybe there is a little bit, would you finally admit maybe there is a little bit of a communication thing between McMillan and the rest of the team going on here?
Well, I mean, again, it gets back to what period we talked about last night. I think, you know, it's an effort thing, and the players obviously didn't respond to the motivational tactics that Nate McMillan used in the practice the day before. But again, in the bigger picture, it's all about winning or losing close games. That's almost it's the story of the season. So, you know, in the bigger picture, I don't think you can escape that.
All right. Who do you blame for this predicament? Because you're saying, oh, you know, the Blazers, they got stuck during the free agency period. You know, they had to kind of slap it together. So Chad did a pretty good job getting Crawford, getting Craig Smith, you know, putting the pieces together at the last minute without Brandon, without Greg. So are you blaming, I mean, assuming that this negative momentum kind of continues and we get to a position where, hey, it's really clear McMillan's job's on the line here. I mean, you asked earlier, should he be fired or not? I mean, are you saying that he escaped some of the blame because of management decisions, ownership decisions, the simple fact of circumstances of injuries, or all of the above? And I guess, how would you prioritize those factors?
All of the above. You know, I don't think that you can point to any one thing that's happened here. But, you know, again, the single biggest factor to me is the situation with the close games. If you look at, you know, the Blazers still have a point differential of, I believe it's plus 3.7 per game. So I just ran a quick study here while we were chatting on the worst records of teams that have ever had differentials of 3.0 or higher. And every single one of those teams has finished the season above 500. You know, obviously, no, that's not happy at that differential a third of the way or, you know, 40% of the way through the season. It's at the end of the year. But every single one of these teams has finished above 500. The funny thing here is that the two worst records in the group belong to Portland Trail Blazers teams.
So are you trying to basically make the argument that, hey, the numbers are so overwhelmingly in Portland's favors to recover or adjust to normal, or I don't know if regress is the right word in mathematically, but you're saying that you got to give Nate the longest leash possible here because the numbers are just so out of whack that eventually they should save his job?
That's my general position. You know, I think that we'll have to see whether situations like last night's continue, but you know,
Okay,
there's
so
not a lot of precedent for what we're seeing.
okay, fair enough. When's the breaking point? Is it the end of the season, or is there a possibility that, you know, All-Star break or just after the All-Star break, where's your breaking point for when you throw up your arms and say, "Hey, guess what? The numbers aren't going to rebound enough to save this guy."
Well, I think part of it is situational. So to me, the big time period right now is the trade deadline because you're going to have to make some decisions about what the direction of the team is. You know, at some point, I think you do have to, if things don't get better and continue getting worse, consider the possibility of looking to rebuild next summer when you have a bunch of free agents. So, you'd have to consider getting some value for Gerald Wallace or possibly moving Wesley Matthews for an expiring contract to try to get more cap space. And, I think eventually you'd sort of build around the Aldridge Batum core.
I think that's what you're going to be forced to do with Matthews as sort of your other reliable rotation guy. Maybe he's a reserve long term. I mean, those are your three contracts that you're probably going to be carrying through into the future. No question about it. Okay, so can we take just a final closing minute here? I mean, this is really chickens coming to home to roost, what we're seeing right now for Paul Allen, right? I mean, years of making, rash personnel decisions, repeated changes of course and not having a clear to the necessary philosophy, or repeated desire to sort of win now, to sacrifice the future, to take on salary maybe at trade deadlines, or to try to, spurt forward a little bit, or prevent backsliding is a phrase I've used before when I write about sort of the Blazers, current organizational philosophy. I mean, all that stuff is sort of all coming to a head and catching up to them right now, isn't it? I mean, aren't we finally getting to the point where maybe this isn't going to be tenable? And it really is going to be time for a rebuild, whether they want to do it or not. I mean, isn't that sort of a good way to characterize the last, say, 3 seasons or 3 years of decision making from Allen?
Well, to me, it mostly is primarily about not having a general manager and just letting them make decisions, because that's the question is who makes a call if you do decide to rebuild and deal away some players? Is that all on Chad? Is that Paul Allen? Is
Oh,
that
that's Allen. I
somebody
mean,
else?
that's all Paul Allen. I think we know that very clearly. I mean, from whatever everyone says is that right now, the way they're operating, Larry Miller, Chad Buchanan, all those guys, they're going to present the options to Allen, and Allen's going to be the one who's going to be asking them, pushing them for further details and recommendations. And those guys, because they've seen what's happened to previous managers, I mean, it's very difficult for anyone to take a firm stance or say anything that, doesn't involve trying to win right now, because that's clearly what he's been trying to do for the last couple of years. So, I mean, if you want to broach the topic of rebuilding, that's going to be very difficult for you to do for your long-term job prospects right now, and Allen may finally be realizing that from here till the end of this season that he's not going to have a choice. And so that might change a little bit for those guys. But, up until this point, those guys have been operating with, hey, you got to put together a team that can advance in the playoffs, period. That's your job description.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk to people around the league, the one thing you hear is that every owner has a certain say. It's more than just a, yes, no at the, we're going to make this move. Every owner is involved, and it's a question of how much. But I think when you look at it historically, that level of involvement from the ownership group, as opposed to delegating authority to a general manager, has not been particularly successful as a formula.
No question. So let's fix the situation for these guys. Do we blow it up at the trade deadline? Or do you just let all these contracts expire and go forward like they sort of, had planned with maximum flexibility for the summer?
I still think too early to say, but I think that's the upside, is that you're not committed to one path or the other necessarily right now. You might lose out on little bit of value if you don't trade Gerald Wallace as an expiring contract, or even Marcus Camby, but it's not like you're stuck with a whole bunch of bad contracts that are going to weigh you down and make it impossible to do anything next summer.
No question. I think what you got to do right now between now and the deadline is shop everybody hard. The only untouchables are Aldridge and Batum. See what you can get. Don't take back any future salary unless it's a player who you feel comfortable with, sort of progressing at the same timeline as Aldridge and Batum. Otherwise, you just kind of ride out this storm. If you get to the point where you're meaningfully out of the playoff chase, then you start to play guys like Elliot Williams a lot more and see what they have. Oh, and here's one final question we forgot to touch on. So let's say they do fire Nate. Who do you think takes over?
I guess Bernie Bickerstaff, right? You go with someone with experience as a head coach.
Well, what did they do last time they wanted to rebuild? Or they last time they needed somebody to kind of come up and clean from a coach, I mean, there is the possibility that we could get a Chad Buchanan interim GM, interim coach dual role, isn't there?
I think you just like the idea of him being interim in both roles. I mean, Chad doesn't have quite as much, was he ever involved as a head coach? With the Pritchard-Bourne group in the ABA.
No, I think he's been a scout, but and maybe like an assistant coach, maybe at some level. I don't know. Maybe he was just a residential advisor. I kind of forget. But wouldn't that be awesome for him to just follow completely in KP's footsteps and get that tag and just get to have that last month of evaluation time?
I think the one thing about when they put in Kevin Pritchard as interim coach was that it sort of ensured that, you'd get a good long look at the young guys the rest of the season. So this year, depending on what direction you take between now and the trade deadline, there may not necessarily be as much of that talent available. I think you probably have a pretty good sense of what Chris Johnson is in the league right now. You might learn a little thing on Nolan Smith. I think Elliot Williams and Babbitt are really the guys that would benefit from that.
Yeah, I think I think I circled the two guys as Nolan Smith and Elliot Williams, and those are the guys they're going to want to get a significant run from if it does get to that point. Obviously, we're getting ahead of ourselves and just kind of speculating right now, but you got to do it. I mean, this is what we've been kind of about for last week, is this does feel like a crossroads. I mean, they definitely feel like between now and the All-Star break, this could go way off the rails real quick. The Aldridge thing just makes it worse. And I think we'll probably leave it on that note, KP. Thanks for defending Nate McMillan. Do you have any final words in support of Nate? Maybe one final argument that you've been sort of hiding in your back pocket about what it is about Nate personally, from your experiences with him, that makes you think this is the guy to carry it through the rest of the season?
Well, first off, I want to say that it's probably okay that we're getting ahead of ourselves because you might not do a podcast for another 18 months. So we need to be
Oh,
prepared just in case.
by the way, I need your analysis for the 2014 draft pick the Blazers made. I'm going to go ahead and just pull up Draft Express here.
There was some European guy whose name they mentioned today. I think that guy sounds great. No, I'm moving on. Well, the final argument I have to offer is, there is the slim outside possibility, that there's a team in Seattle next year. So if Nate McMillan were to come available as a head coach at the same time, well, I wouldn't be unhappy about that.
Oh my gosh. So you're going to go poach the Kings one week and then poach the Blazers coach the next week. Man, you are just on a mission to right all the wrongs, settle all the scores. You're like a little Corleone here. This is amazing. I didn't see that coming at all. Blindsided. Et tu, Brutus. All right, man. Thanks for defending Nate McMillan. You rested your case. I'm not sure you convinced me at all. I'm not sure you convinced any Blazers fans. But if there are any diehard Nate McMillan fans out there, I'm sure they're glad to hear your thoughts. And you did raise some good points. So we'll catch up with you next week when Blazers coach Nate McMillan has been fired.
Always a pleasure.
Just kidding. All right, take it easy, man.
Killer did mixtapes. CEOs heard, now here come Big Cake. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup. For you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, I own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, grow entertainment. Sports, drugs, entertainment. To the arraignment killer.